Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today I'm joined by an internationally acclaimed author and cartoonist whose books include Putin's Russia, The Age of Selfishness, How to Fake a Moon Landing, and Billionaires, The Lives of the Rich and Powerful. Daryl Cunningham, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Hello, thank you for inviting me on.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that we are currently in the midst of KBOO's all-important winter membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to become a member of KBOO. Because we're still being cautious and not yet opening up our studios, we don't have volunteers in the station to take your calls right now, but you can show your support by giving online, kboo.fm, or text KBOO to 44321. KBOO is one of the very last media outlets that still brings you local and independent news, music, and public affairs. We've been doing this here in Portland for over half a century, and this program has been coming to you for nearly 20 years now, inviting important cultural figures into the studio and venturing out to events that might fly beneath the radar of the big media monoliths. So yes, you can support this very special programming today by going online to kboo.fm/give, or simply text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. So Daryl, thanks for joining us today from across the pond.
It was very nice to see a bit of Portland, if just through like the screen here.
Well, let's talk about your newest project, Putin's Russia, The Rise of a Dictator. This book has barely hit bookshelves, and events are already threatening to overtake it.
Yes, well, when I did my previous book, Billionaires, which is a book about the 1%, you know, the multi-billionaire class, really. And that's a book that breaks down to sort of three sections, where I do sort of mini biographies of Jeff Bezos, of Amazon, the Koch brothers, who are oil and gas billionaires, and Rupert Murdoch, obviously well known for his media empire. And I was doing the sort of rounds publicizing that. And I kept saying, as a joke, really, oh, my next book's going to be about Putin. Not really thinking it would be. But then I started to think, well, actually, that's a really good subject, because he actually is part of the billionaire class. He's one of the richest people on the planet, although he's not really judged in that way, because we don't really know how much he actually has, but he's thought to be at least 20 billion, which puts him in the top five richest people on the planet, and massively influential just because of that. So, and I realized we don't really know much about him as a person, knew nothing about his childhood, where he came from. All I knew really was that he's an ex-KGB guy, which is interesting in itself. So I started digging around and looking into his, what we knew about his past. It's obviously like there's a lot of subterfuge and myth-making going on there. But we know some specific, absolutely irrefutable facts about him, that he was born in what was Leningrad and is now St. Petersburg, just after the Second World War. His parents survived the siege of Leningrad, barely surviving him. Actually, they almost starved to death, and his father was injured very badly. His father is thought to have been like a member of the intelligence services at that time. And as a young kid, when he was growing up, he's always a little guy. He's a little guy, and he was a little kid. But that didn't stop him brutally fighting people on the streets of Leningrad. His friends of his group with him at the time report that he was a really dirty fighter, that he was like, he would bite, he would kick, he would scratch anything to win a fight. And I think that says a lot about the character of him, right? He's still a very dirty fighter. He'll use any method to get his way, really. He hates losing. He hates losing. And that's what you've got to understand about him, really. As he was growing up, he was sort of very interested in, like, the KGB. He thought it was a cool thing, because obviously his father came out of that area. His father was originally a submarine captain, I think. but he worked on submarines and then he worked in intelligence. So he wanted to go into that, and eventually contacted them and served in Dresden in Germany for many years, and then came back and got into politics. And the rest is, as I say, history.
Yes, he benefited from some flukes of history when the Soviet Union fell. And he sort of found himself swept away by events, and then he just started making events himself.
I think that all the time, though, he had powerful friends, ex-KGB people who now have powerful places, mysteriously sort of organizing meetings and putting pressure on people to give him a job. So he was moved up, you know, as they tended to do, they move their people around into positions of whatever power they could. And so he got a job in the mayor's office originally in St. Petersburg, next to the mayor. So he started working there and was implicated in massive corruption almost immediately. Like literally millions of dollars worth of food sort of disappeared that was ordered for the city. And that money all went into not just his pocket, but the general sort of KGB fund, I think, is what he speculated on. And after that, he got a job in Moscow when the Soviet Union was collapsing and Boris Yeltsin was president of Russia. He managed to get a position very close to him. Again, mysteriously got this job. We can only speculate how this happened. And then eventually it seems that he did a deal with Boris Yeltsin that if he stepped down, then he wouldn't be prosecuted if Putin took charge. So Putin took charge with the understanding that he would not prosecute Yeltsin for any corruption at all. So that's how he got to become president of Russia. And he's been there ever since, more than 20 years now.
Yes. So like you mentioned, Russia's first post-Soviet president, Boris Yeltsin, he steps down the end of 1999. Vladimir Putin steps in. He's been in control of Russia ever since. And when people talk about the invasion of Ukraine, some folks say that Putin's finally gone over the edge, that he's been getting all his advice from yes men. There are other people who say that he's always been reckless and foolhardy, but that his crazy risks have somehow all paid off in the past. They've all succeeded. And this time might turn out to be different.
Well, I hope that's the case, but it's generally the case that it's always been like this. It's always been, if you look at the war in Chechnya previously, or the war in Syria, which they helped prop up Assad, it's always been the same. You see the same pattern unfolding now, where they indiscriminately target populations, buildings, hospitals. They'll reduce these Ukrainian cities to literal rubble, and that millions of people will be displaced. This is what's going to happen. If they just do the same playbook as they always do, that's what's going to happen.
Well, Putin has certainly been ferocious on the front of conventional warfare, but you talk about information warfare, where he really shines. Russian propagandists game the social media algorithms and create a manufactured consensus that gives legitimacy to fringe views and conspiracy theories.
That's been the case for the past 10 years, especially, where they have like dominated all social media to push their points across. And a lot of people have fallen for these conspiracy theories, the latest being that NATO provoked this invasion, which certainly isn't the case. But I think certainly in the past, we've seen that collapse. They've absolutely not dominating the social media at the moment. They've, in fact, their publicity machine is definitely faltering. They're not getting the message across at all. So we've seen the response, really. Ordinary people are turning against Russia and Putin, except for the very hard right, I think.
Well, it's interesting. Right up until Putin's invasion of Ukraine, he had maybe not political allies in the West, but certainly apologists all across the political spectrum, left, right, libertarian, authoritarian. And the accusation that would get thrown at Putin's critics was, well, you're being McCarthyist, which is curious because McCarthyism was a Cold War anti-communist ideology, and Putin is a 21st century multi-billionaire plutocrat, some would say a kleptocrat.
Absolutely, and I've certainly been accused of Russophobia. But what we have to remember is that Russian people were the first victims of Putin. They've had their media gradually tightly controlled until it's almost non-existent now. They're, you know, even just this week, we've seen further suppression of media. So they're not really getting any information through, except sort of illegally, really. I mean, you can get stuff like the BBC on the dark web and things like that. I think that's they're getting through. But and we've also seen Putin's crime cartel sort of systematically rob the country of its wealth for two decades. And that's why they're so incredibly wealthy. The group of oligarchs surround Putin. Putin himself has a massive palace on the shores of the Black Sea. It's absolutely incredible, full of everything you could ever want, really, including probably nuclear bunkers, fallout bunkers, as big as a town.
Yeah, you quote a hedge fund manager named Bill Browder. His firm, Hermitage Capital, was heavily invested in Russia. And he estimates that Putin has accumulated $200 billion of ill-gotten gains. That's eye-watering.
Yeah, most of this money is like mobsters of old, apparently held by other people. So you can't directly implicate him in it, but they're just like placeholders for this money. And that includes, and I have to be careful with my words, some of the oligarchs who surround Putin. You have to question whether that money is really theirs or whether it's Putin's, because they basically have to do what they're told. I mean, early on in Putin's regimes, there were oligarchs who fought back, but they were either jailed, had to run into exile, or were literally just murdered. So they know if they want to keep their wealth, they have to keep on Putin's good side, and that means paying him off to some degree.
Well, you certainly don't let your own home country of the UK off the hook, and you don't let the US off the hook either, because unlike most other countries, England and the States allow anonymous investment in real estate on a large scale. So while we've been experiencing these terrible homelessness crises and affordable housing crises, there are giant investment properties sitting vacant that are just used for money laundering.
Absolutely. I mean, I spend a short back and forth between this country and New York, and I was there for 3 months just recently, and I was staying up in the Upper East Side. And in the Upper East Side, many of those multi-million dollar buildings are owned by Russian oligarchs. You can walk from one to the other in 5 minutes. Roman Abramovich, who's the owner of the soccer football club Chelsea in this country, he owns numerous properties in New York, for example. So, and they're always, as you say, they're probably vacant most of the time. And the same in London. It's just a way of getting their money out of Russia and making more money for them, really. Meanwhile, it has massive effect on property prices in those cities and eventually rent prices to the poorest people. So it does have a definite effect.
So you see all the great mob movies that are set in New York, and they always portray the Italian mob, the Sicilian mob. But really, the Italian mafia's territory has been taken over largely by the Russian mafia. And you quote a couple of authors. One of them is Craig Unger, who wrote a book called American Compromat, How the KGB Cultivated Donald Trump and Related Tales of Sex, Greed, Power, and Treachery, and where Donald Trump's father, Fred Trump, was in bed with the Italian mafia. Donald has really spent his life working hand in glove with the Russian mob.
It does seem to be the case. Many of the apartments in Trump Tower, originally when it was originally built, were owned by Russian mobsters, came in with a lot of the Russian people who live around Coney Island, around that area, and certainly he's been dealing with. He was early on dealing with them very closely, and he's been associated with Russian businessmen ever since, and has led to international deals. There was a before I became president, there was an attempt to build a Trump Tower in Moscow, which never came off. But all the things happened there, mysterious things. We don't really know what happened, really. It's hard to speculate. And I'm very reluctant to say on the air because it gets sued, really.
Yes, I know that Britain tends to have a different civil legal system than the US has. You can't say things quite as brazenly.
That's very true.
Well, you know, we're talking about Donald Trump, and certainly Putin still has apologists here in the US, and Trump seems to be among them. They're all super shady apologists like Steve Bannon and Eric Prince, who worked closely with Trump. They openly admire what Putin's done in Russia, turning the country into an authoritarian ethnostate. And they haven't been shy about their plans to do the same to the US.
Absolutely. And we're seeing Sean Hannity on Fox pushing this agenda, the pro-Putin agenda. So there's plenty of people there who, despite the Ukraine war, are still on the side of Putin and still think, in fact, that he's justified in invading Ukraine, which I find incredible. But there you are, that there should be so many people on the hard right and some among the libertarian community who believe that Putin is right here.
Well, you mentioned Fox News, the purveyors of misinformation. They don't actually have to get the population to believe lies. They just need to create enough confusion that people doubt everything, including the most basic facts.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's an old technique, is it? There's this book, The Merchants of Doubt, but it was originally about how the tobacco industry started this sort of technique of just throwing out everything, all sorts of information, just to make you doubt the scientific credibility of the link between cancer and smoking. And this technique now seems to be taken about by many people. If reality is against you, what you do is you throw everything at it to make people doubt it, really. You just swamp with information. You don't know then what is true and what is false. So it's an attack on reality itself, if you like.
Yeah, you quote author David Petrikarakos. He says, Russia's approach is to confuse every issue with so many narratives that people can't recognize the truth when they see it.
That's absolutely true. And that's why it's on everybody, really, to educate yourself and make sure that whatever information you get, you can double check it somewhere else. It's not just enough to watch some guy's YouTube video. You have to really check it out. I mean, one thing we did when we were doing this book, and this book is much more of a collaborative effort than I've ever done before, because I work very closely with my editor and my fact checker to rigorously go through all the information in it to a point where I was like a nervous wreck by then. So it was well worth doing. So you just be very careful about the information you get. Always, your instant response in getting any information from the internet is to doubt it, especially if it's something you want to believe, because that's how they get you, really. If it looks like something you want to believe, that's when you must be most critical, if anything.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're talking with Daryl Cunningham, the author of the graphic histories, Putin's Russia, The Age of Selfishness, and Billionaires, The Lives of the Rich and Powerful. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the midst of our winter membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to become a member of KBOO. Our studios are still closed to phone volunteers, but we have all sorts of options for donating. If you'd like to pledge on the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Daryl Cunningham. The thing about Putin is, after more than 20 years in power, Putin has remade Russia in his own image, and he's the one person who knows how to run the machinery. One of these days, the person will be gone. And as bad as things are in Russia right now, that's when the country is going to come in for a real reckoning, is post-Putin.
It's hard to know what will happen. It's just, you can't imagine it. I mean, with the old Soviet Union, there was always a structure of succession in place, but there isn't here. It's hard to know what he's thinking, who he thinks. If he wanted to retire, he'd really need to have the same deal from his successor that he gave to Boris Yeltsin, that he couldn't be prosecuted for corruption or anything like that afterwards. But in his own mind, I suspect that this is the reason why he's still in power. He can't do it. He's in that chair. And we've all seen those photos recently of him at one end of a very long table. And this seems to me, it's not just about COVID. I think he is a very paranoid man at this point. He's in the last stages of what I think of as dictatorship megalomania, which always happens with these characters after a couple of decades. They literally cannot trust anyone. Everyone is their enemy. And I wonder even, and this is pure speculation on my part, whether he's even had the vaccine, because I wonder if he can trust anyone to inject anything into his body, considering that he routinely poisons his enemies. There's a very good story in my book about Anna Politkovskaya, who was a journalist, and she was on a plane and she ordered a cup of tea and was poisoned. So poison can come from anywhere in the Russian system, and he must be more chronically there aware of anything. I'm sure he has like food tasters and everything. It's like kings of old who can't trust anyone. Yeah, this is what I suspect. I don't know this for sure. But it's interesting, really. And who can be a successor? He's probably going to have to die now in place like Stalin did. There's no one you can really trust, I wonder.
So Putin's overarching goal, aside from accumulating power and wealth for himself, has been to undermine alliances among Western nations. And one of the projects that Putin took a personal interest in, and many people didn't notice this until it was too late, was the Brexit campaign that ended up ripping Britain out of the European Union.
I haven't covered this in the book as much as I should have. There was a court case going on in London, which made me a bit wary of touching it, because one of the main figures in this area is incredibly litigious. But I may come back to it if I update the book in the future. But basically, a lot of Russian money came into the pro-Putin campaign, five various businessmen. And also, and we know this for sure, that our government, the Conservative Party, has also accepted enormous amounts of money from oligarchs very close to Putin. So that has also sort of affected their judgment and, I believe, corrupted the government to some degree. We've seen countries have sanctioned the oligarchs, but you will notice that our country, the UK, has sanctioned them almost the least, really. In fact, I think it's the sanctions are from like America and other places have come in instantly, but they've not come in instantly here. It's been 30 days before they come in, and that gives a lot of people, certain oligarchs, time to sort of remove their money. And this looks very suspicious to me.
Yeah, Boris Johnson is clearly the biggest beneficiary of the Brexit campaign in the UK.
That's true. One of the donors to the Conservative Party funds got himself a seat in the House of Lords a couple of years ago. And that's how bad it is, really.
Well, the US did not learn from what happened with Brexit and the misinformation campaign. And you go right into the 2016 Trump campaign when there was a hack of the Democratic Party's computer systems. And Trump said, "Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing."
That's true. I mean, Trump's relationship has continued with Russia all the way through and to this day, really. In the future, I don't think that he's going to have such an easy ride, because Russia is now seen in such a negative view in the United States, especially, that he's going to be tied to that. I'd be interested to see how that affects him going forward, really. He may have to start distancing himself a little bit. And I've gone through much of the things that he's actually said about Putin in Russia. And I can almost find nothing, not one occasion where he's ever criticized Russia or Putin. He seems like absolutely incapable of doing it for whatever reason. We can speculate why, really, but he just can't do it. And he'll give them a break whenever they can. I'm surprised, actually, that the US stayed in NATO during Trump's time. I think that he was incredibly negative about NATO, and I think would have liked to withdraw the United States if he could have.
Yep, that seems to be a backfiring kind of comeuppance from Putin's invasion of Ukraine, was that NATO, which was really on the ropes during Trump's term, is now emboldened.
Well, yes, I mean, something I see often from commentators on the far left is that the eastward sort of march of NATO provoked Russia into this, and to some extent bears some of the blame. But that's simply not true, I think, because I think this would have happened anyway. Putin wanted Ukraine. Whether NATO existed or not, that would have happened. In fact, it could have happened earlier if NATO wasn't there. It could have happened 10 years ago. In fact, it could have happened when Russia annexed Crimea. They could have just continued on and taken the rest of the country, but they didn't do it at that time. Now perhaps Putin is thinking he's wishing he had done when Trump was his ally. But it's just much more difficult to do that. I suppose he can't count on Trump ever becoming president again. So he's doing it now.
Well, fingers crossed there. You know, it's not to say that Western governments have spotlessly clean hands when it comes to disinformation campaigns and election meddling. Not at all. But Putin's brazenness sets him apart.
It's true. I mean, I'm not saying that the US, the UK, NATO itself is in any way like whiter than white. There are other areas of the world we know that dubious things are still happening. But we have to deal with the matter at hand. And the most urgent problem is Ukraine. So we have to talk about that, really, and not be distracted away from that.
Yeah, there's certainly hacking and misinformation industries in the UK, in the US, in Israel. But the hacking and misinformation industry in Russia, the scope is outrageous. It just seems to be the most well-funded sector of Putin's economy.
Certainly, and there seems to be a lot of the disinformation about vaccines, COVID vaccines, came out of Russia to try and discredit that, with the aim, I think, to stop Western citizens taking up the vaccine. That's an incredibly malevolent thing to do, that they did that, but that's what happened. And it's interesting to say a lot of those things, a lot of those trolls have suddenly disappeared from the internet. I don't see as much activity now as it did even a week ago. But also we can't forget as well that Rupert Murdoch has also been pushing out a lot of disinformation because he aligns with a lot of the very authoritarian politics that Putin represents. And certainly Fox News has been pushing out a lot of absolute nonsense and flat-out lies about Putin, Russia, Ukraine, vaccines, all sorts of stuff.
You're mentioning an earlier book that you wrote called Billionaires, The Lives of the Rich and Powerful. And you profile sort of three case studies, and there are Jeff Bezos, Rupert Murdoch, and the Koch brothers. And well, as far as the Koch brothers go, it's down to Charles Koch now. David Koch died in 2019. One of the points you make in the book is that the super rich are not really bound by the laws of any nation.
No, because I mean, the Koch brothers were responsible for the deaths of two teenagers in Texas when a gas pipeline blew up and they were burned alive. And they were like fined massively, millions of dollars for that. But for the Kochs, for the Koch industry, these kind of fines are just the price of doing business, and they'll just brush it off and just get on with that. They're not going to be held personally responsible for the deaths of people. So there is that. And you've got to think obviously a big fine would ruin almost any normal person, but it's nothing to these big companies and, you know, very powerful individuals. You know, if there was real, if there were low IT, there would be prison time for those people at the very top. But because there isn't, they're able to just get on and do whatever they like, really.
Yeah, it seems like governments are competing to show the most fealty to the super rich. Your profile of Rupert Murdoch, going back to the early 80s in the UK, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and her people would bend the rules or pretty much throw them out the window to give Rupert Murdoch a leg up in the British media landscape.
Certainly, because they got a lot of support back in those days, the 70s. I mean, there was no internet, so newspapers were king. And that's, if you wanted to get your propaganda and information across, so you had to have like media barons like Rupert Murdoch on your side. And that's what they did. They worked very closely together, him and Margaret Thatcher, to make sure that she always got back in power if possible. And in return, he got a lot of help in union busting, that kind of thing. So, yeah, they worked hand in glove for many years.
Yeah, here in the U.S., Rupert Murdoch had no better friend than Newt Gingrich, who was the Republican House Speaker back in the 1990s. He pushed for the deregulation that destroyed all of the safeguards against monopolies, destroyed local news, consolidated media in the hands of a few corporations, such as Murdoch's News Corporation.
Absolutely. What makes incredibly, what I find incredible, is that when Margaret Thatcher and in the Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher era in the 70s, 80s, that it was all about, from the conservative side, free markets and that kind of thing. But if they've obviously gone against free markets, because if we genuinely wanted free markets, we'd break up a lot of these big companies like Amazon and Google, let other smaller companies in. But they seem to be fine in letting these huge companies like Apple and so on like gobble up everything and stifle competition. And that's been very bad for us all, I think, that they've been allowed to do this. Certainly, things like Facebook bought Instagram, for example. That shouldn't have been allowed, really. That, you know, they just owned too much, really. It should be Disney owns what? Star Wars, 20th Century Fox, Lucasfilm. It's just far too much. I mean, what good does it do to have them to own almost half of Hollywood? And you can, in terms of culture, it leads to sort of homogenous group of amount of stuff. And it doesn't allow smaller companies, it doesn't allow technical innovation or creative innovation. So I'm very against that. And I found myself in coming back to, in a way, a small conservative, old-fashioned conservative point of view politically, in that I too now believe in free markets, when once upon a time I decried them. Now it seems like a good idea.
Well, these legal fictions that we call corporations, they started out a few centuries ago, mainly in England and her colonies. And they were very limited contractual arrangements. They were never meant to stick around for long periods of time or gobble up other corporations or be granted personhood by the courts.
Well, yes, I mean, certainly we should, you know, anti-competitive, anti-monopoly laws exist, but they're not being enforced as they should be. And the government organizations that are supposed to be policing all this are not funding enough, especially in the United States. And not only that, but we're also seeing sort of the revolving door thing as well, where people from the government departments are now hiring people from the very companies supposed to be policing. So if you like, the government departments themselves end up being captured. We saw Trump appointing all sorts of people high up in regulatory positions. Basically, and their job was to destroy that department, like the EPA, for example.
It's interesting that these people who consider themselves populists have lined up behind a New York playboy from a wealthy family. Donald Trump, of course, comes from money. Virtually every billionaire comes from a wealthy family, including the ones in your book. The myth of the self-made tycoon is really just that. It's a myth.
That's absolutely true. I mean, Murdoch inherited millions from his father, who owned a newspaper already, and he built up from there. The Koch brothers inherited it from their father, Fred, who was super rich already. Bezos is the only one who's slightly different. His stepfather's father was a Cuban immigrant who came to the United States with basically nothing as a child, and he trained himself up to be an oil executive and did very well and got into the middle class. And some of his money was seed money for the origins of the beginning of Amazon. So Bezos may not be a self-made man, but he came from quite low down.
His partners at Amazon were quite wealthy.
Yeah, and he was in a position to get a good investment. It's his father who's the self-made man, if you think about it.
Yeah, some people say that where we once had class mobility, we're now headed towards a new version of feudalism, where the wealthy few own the land, the homes, and the really valuable commodity, all the data.
I'd like to think that the present moment would see people waking up a bit and sort of fighting back generally against all of this. But only time will say, really.
I have to wonder, whatever happened to the Panama Papers? You mentioned the Panama Papers in passing, but there was this big dump of, you know, scandalous information about the super rich that came out, and then just crickets from the corporate media, from the legacy media.
They're not really interested in pushing a lot of these stories because their owners are people like Rupert Murdoch, who benefit from these very, beneficial financial systems. So, you know, there is that. So I don't know. And also, it's just hard to try and get people interested in economics anyway. So I do my best.
So another of your graphic nonfiction books is The Age of Selfishness, Ayn Rand, Morality, and the Financial Crisis. And for those who don't know, Ayn Rand was a writer of very clunky novels who ended up influencing major economic thinkers such as Alan Greenspan.
That's right. I mean, she's key figure in the libertarian movement, really, and considered herself a philosopher. And she was quite a strange woman. She was a Russian emigre, and she came to the US and worked originally around sort of Hollywood, writing screenplays and wrote novels. A very fearsome woman who, like a kind of cult started to develop around her. And the young Alan Greenspan was sort of part of that, a 1950 sort of group of libertarian thinkers, really. And he took some of the ideas into the Federal Reserve when he became chair. And a lot of the deregulation that happened prior to the financial crisis that helped banks sort of become dangerously unstable and financial systems were due to Alan Greenspan in the US, not just deregulating, which he did, but also not really enforcing the regulations that were already in place. So the Randians very much believe in sort of an anti-government sort of stance. The less regulation, the better. But as we've seen, you do really need some regulation because otherwise things get completely out of control. And in the end, it's the taxpayer who has to pick up the tab for that.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're talking with Daryl Cunningham, the author of the graphic histories, Putin's Russia, The Age of Selfishness, and Billionaires, The Lives of the Rich and Powerful. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the midst of our winter membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to become a member of KBOO. Our studios are still closed to phone volunteers, but we have all sorts of options for donating. If you'd like to pledge on the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Daryl Cunningham. So you place the economic crash of 2007-2008 squarely at the feet of the followers of Ayn Rand, the libertarians, the free marketeers. These are the people who don't believe in the common good necessarily, don't believe in a healthy middle class. They're sort of a law of the jungle crowd.
Rand wrote a long piece about how she felt that selflessness was a kind of vice in itself, really. She believed that self-interest was the best way to approach things, because in that way, you know, everybody got what they wanted, really, in some way. I think she was damaged, really, by she was growing up in Soviet Russia at that time, and she saw how the sort of collective was used, the idea of the collective good was used to sort of get power away from ordinary people and hold them in place. So she was very suspicious of anything that was sort of left-wing or socialist in that stripe. She was against that kind of thing, but she went too far the other way, really, into almost like a circle, back to almost being authoritarian herself. And she was, in her own personal life, very authoritarian and towards her husband and her friends and family and the sort of little cult of people that she generated around her. She's a fascinating figure and a kind of horrifying figure at the same time.
And famously, she lived out her final days at the government trough, getting Social Security and all kinds of government money that she so despised.
Yes, I mean, the argument that was made on her behalf is that, well, she's paid into it all over life. It's, yes, that is the point of it in the first place.
You know, I couldn't help but notice that there's a thread running between the three of your books, Putin's Russia, The Age of Selfishness, and Billionaires. And that thread is Russia in the late 1920s, early 30s, when, Vladimir Putin's parents were struggling, Ayn Rand escaped, and the Koch brothers' father, Fred, got his start there in the oil business.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Eastern Europe, Germany, Fred Koch actually worked in a sort of pre-Second World War Germany as well, was connected with the Nazi movement. And he also was a founding member of the Birch Society as well.
John Birch Society, yes.
Yes. It was a very extreme authoritarian movement. So these things keep cropping up all the time. It's hard for us to see as individuals because we live sort of relatively short lives, but the sort of process of history are very long and often work out much longer than our lives. So we're seeing almost like the re-emergence of the Soviet Union again in Russia, like old systems coming back, despite the fact that all the people originated are long dead, and yet it's coming back again. It's hard to see what the connections are, where it really works, really. But it's like some things just persist through time in some mysterious way, really. There's probably concrete reasons for this, but whatever those concrete reasons are, it does elude me, and perhaps there's a book to be written on that subject.
I was just thinking, there's an irony in that the one multi-billionaire that you're profiling, who actually came from a poor background, was Vladimir Putin. And if Senator Joe McCarthy or any of the John Birch Society people were around today, they might consider Vladimir Putin a great example of a rags-to-riches character, a real Horatio Alger type.
Well, that's true. You could see it that way, but he had a lot of help along the way, didn't he? Really?
Well, they all do, don't they?
Well, they do. Yeah, that's true.
There's a book. In England, it's known as Science Tales. In the U.S., it's known as How to Fake a Moon Landing, Exposing the Myths of Science Denial. Tell us a little bit about this book.
Well, I wanted to do a science book, and I was particularly interested in subjects which is not really well understood by the general public, or there was a lot of misinformation about them. It's a theme of mine, really. So I'm looking around, and I listened at that time, I was listening to a lot of science podcasts, and it seemed that the same subjects, misunderstood subjects that they were addressing were coming up time and time again. They're almost self-selecting, really. Things like evolution, which is not controversial, particularly in Europe, but it is in many parts of the world, and even the United States. Various alternative therapies like homeopathy and chiropractic. Vaccination, this is before COVID. I wrote a chapter about the anti-vax movement as it then was, and the MMR vaccine, particularly the measles, mumps and rubella vaccine, and how people are associating that with autism. There's absolutely no connection between the two, but that myth persists, really. So I wrote a book about all these things. So yeah, it was an interesting book to do. Perhaps I should revisit that subject at some point.
Yeah, I was interested when I saw you talk about your artistic influences that there weren't a whole lot of cartoonists in there. I suppose George Gross counts, but you're very fond of early 20th century German illustrators like Egon Schiele and Gustav Klimt.
Yeah, they were, when I was at art college, they were sort of the flavour of the time, really. People were always very interested in those kind of illustrators. But, I mean, you know, I mean, I'm a comics reader from a kid, so the influence of, like, Jack Kirby and people like that are still, like, quite kind of profound. Not necessarily showing up in my artwork, but the way I sort of think about comics and layout come from years of reading mainstream superhero stuff. I'm certainly not dismissive of superhero stuff in any way. Some great writers have worked in that, and artists have worked in that medium. I recently got two big collections of Mike Mignola's Hellboy, and I love that artwork. I wish I could draw as well as he can. I'm not a young person, and after a few decades, you get so many experiences. It's hard to know anymore after a while what your influences have been, because it's such a massive mixture of things. When you're certainly young, when you're in your 20s or a teenager, you can sort of see just a few things, a handful of things perhaps influencing you. By the time you get to your early 60s, you've seen, read too much stuff to know where it's all coming from. And in a way, that's a rather beautiful thing, really. Because there's such this great mass of influences coming through and just pours out of you if you let it.
So your art style in all of these books, these graphic nonfiction books, Billionaires, Putin's Russia, The Age of Selfishness, it's very minimal, almost iconic.
My approach really is to make things as simple visually as possible. The information I'm trying to get across is so complex, you don't really want to get in the way, really, of the text. You don't want people wondering where to look on the page first, or try to keep to a grid system so you know exactly where to start reading it. So you're sort of reading it very simply. It's like good editing in a movie. You shouldn't be aware of the cuts. You just see the movement of the film as it moves along, and I don't want people to be aware really of the frames. So I take a very simple approach. I take a sort of muted color scheme, just so that people can just sort of fall into the book and get the information directly, not try to be too clever with the visuals, really.
Yeah, the where characters are interacting, there's a lot of gestures, but not always faces.
No, I think I've changed my style a bit as I've gone along. I've gone, Putin was more photographically based than I've done before, both basically because I wanted it to be, you know, as realistic as possible. There are cartoon sections in it, but I try to go for a more straightforward sort of illustrative style. But I think I've probably got to the end of that kind of style. My next book, whatever it will be much more cartoonier in approach, I think.
What can you tell us about this upcoming project?
Well, much to everyone's surprise, I've decided to do like a work of fiction next. And I'm going to leave non-fiction behind, just write an actual proper graphic novel, which I originally, when I came into cartoons, started doing cartooning, I was a fiction writer. So I'm really returning to my roots in doing a book that's like a sort of gothic novel, really. The story of a family who face a series of supernatural crises and is set in two time periods in England in the early 70s and the 1820s. So it's like strange, like a mix of Regency era stuff and 1970s stuff.
Well, you are fond of science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah, so it's my attempt to do sort of like a Hammer film, if you like, really.
Ah, yes. The
grew up on as a teenager, so I love those things.
The classic 1960s and 70s horror films.
Yeah, very much so.
You have a webcomic strip called The Streets of San Diablo. It involves a couple of characters named Super Sam and John of the Night. The Streets of San Diablo is sort of a Western set in the afterlife. It's on land leased from hell.
Yeah, well, I originally started because I was asked to do a strip for the Forbidden Planet book chain for their website. So I just started to do this Super Sam strip, which originally was like a 3 or 4 panel gag strip. But eventually, like a storyline emerged, and that became like The Streets of San Diablo. I may come back to that at some point.
Soon to be a major motion picture from Alex Cox.
That'd be good. I've seen a film from Alex Cox, really.
It seems like there's some influences in there from horror films or the likes of Guillermo del Toro or somebody.
I think it's partly Sergio Leone, but certainly I wanted to do something set in the afterlife because I wanted to have characters who had died.
You've had experience with acute depression, and you also, early on, you worked as a healthcare assistant on an acute psychiatric ward. That led to a book that you published called Psychiatric Tales.
That's true. That was the first book, really, that got me into this taking sort of big subjects and then writing, drawing sort of explanatory comics about them. And that came about because I've been working as a sort of untrained healthcare assistant on an acute psychiatric ward. And after a few years, I thought, well, I might as well get trained as a mental health nurse because I'm basically doing the job anyway. So it's a 3-year course. And after about 2 years, and I've been doing the job for 5 or 6 years at this point, I realized I was completely burned out and could not continue. And it was having massive effects on my own mental health. So I had to stop, really. But out of that experience, I thought, because people kept coming to me and saying, well, I don't know how you can do that job, it must be really tough. And I realized that people didn't really understand what it was like. They didn't understand what it was like to work in mental health, but they didn't really understand, more to the point, what mental illness was in all the sort of variations. So I wrote this book, Psychiatric Tales, which is sort of chapter by chapter that looks at different mental health issues like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, that kind of thing, and sort of try to break down the myths and get rid of this sort of stigma that's attached to a lot of these things, these illnesses. So that was my first book. And I couldn't initially get a publisher, so I just started sticking these short strips online, and I got an enormous following, and then publishers came to me, and then the rest is Daryl Cunningham history, basically. That's how it all happened. So what I always tell young cartoonists is really sort of build a following first online, and then you've got like something to bring to publishers, because otherwise it's difficult for them to assess you, really, rather than the old days, which is much more difficult, sending stuff by the post, and eventually it'll end up on a kind of slush pile. And then some intern might look at it after about 3 months. Now you've got instant access, and you might as well use that.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today has been Daryl Cunningham. He's the author of the graphic nonfiction books, Putin's Russia, The Age of Selfishness, How to Fake a Moon Landing, and Billionaires, The Lives of the Rich and Powerful. Daryl, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I very much enjoyed this long, long talk. Thank you.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your books, your other comics, your science fiction stuff, where would they look?
I have a website, but I'm on Facebook, Twitter. You can access my publisher, Drawn and Quarterly, Myriad Editions in the UK. So, you know, stick my name in Google, it'll all come up.
And that's Daryl with two R's and a Y.
That's right. Yeah, two R's and a Y.
Well, we hope that everybody has been enjoying our special programming for KBOO's Winter Membership Drive. Before we go, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that this community radio station needs your support, as our physical studios are remaining closed for the time being. To become a member of KBOO, or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Or if you prefer, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @wordsandpicture.